text or WhatsApp your view to Greg on 086 60 25,000.
Well, give us a call 07491 25,000 if you want to. We were talking yesterday on a serious matter. Saoirse from Donegal Town, she had a warning for people who might start the car and go into the house and warm the car up, you know what I mean. It's a normal thing, we all have done it, I'm sure, at one time or other. But she came out and had quite a distressing experience whereby she found someone sitting in the car. And then it reminded me of my mother, who on a number of occasions, and it was hilarious, got into a wrong car as Dad sat in another car and the diamond bib in the horn saying, "Gwen, you're in the wrong car." But anyway, so it's led to other people saying they've done the same and other mishaps, okay? So we want share your mishaps with us. And if it's something you remain embarrassed about, you know, share it with me and I promise I'll rid you of your embarrassment by reading it aloud, okay? And you can move on with the rest of your life. But I think often these things make for great anecdotes. But what about this one from a listener? Greg, a few years ago, I did this at a New Year's Eve party. I'd only been to my friend's house once and thought I was in the right house. I put the items for the party on the kitchen table. I poured myself a drink and went into the sitting room and sat down. This woman sat looking at me and says, "Where?" This woman sits looking at me and I say, "Where's everyone?" And she says, "Who are you looking for?" I nearly died of embarrassment when I realised I was in the house next door. Thankfully, the house owner took it in good spirits into the kitchen, laid out his goodies or her goodies, poured themselves a drink and went and sat in the front room with the next door neighbour. Have you had any similar experiences like that? Please share them with us. And if it is something that is still a source of embarrassment for you, allow us to rid you of that embarrassment by broadcasting it on the radio and thus throwing it into the atmosphere. People walking their dogs in Rafoque, we're making a New Year's resolution for dog owners to pick up after their dogs. Now with the snow and ice, it's harder to see it, so you're always on top of it before you know, and it's disgusting. It's one thing we could rid for 25, isn't it? It's the small number of irresponsible dog owners that make dog ownership for other responsible people actually a bit toxic, and it shouldn't. If your dog does a poo on outside, just pick it up and take it home. It's such a simple thing to do, and it will be good for all dog owners as well. That's one thing we could get rid of on 2025 or in 2025. A caller says an independent walks alone and decides what's best for them and their constituents. Being a member of a party means that you have to always toe the party line. I agree to a certain extent, but part of the agreement between this group of independents and the government is that they will support the government on matters such as votes of no confidence, or maybe to get controversial legislation passed. So whilst many independents are like that, Thomas Pringle probably would be a good example of someone who didn't engage in horse trading types of politics, there are those that come together as a group of independents and do commit to support the government in certain areas, as we saw in the last government. So I agree, some independents walk alone and decide what's best for them and their constituents. Others do get together as a collective, call themselves a name, and commit to voting in favour of government, even if it goes against what they believe. Good morning, Greg. So a new year, but alas, nothing has changed. Donegal still the forgotten county. The orange weather warning couldn't even find us. Were we only county remaining yellow? Yes, we were, and I don't get it, really, to be honest with you. We had some of the lowest temperatures in the country last night. They can't get it right all of the time, but, you know, it's a state agency, Metairn, you know. It's not a... We have people, and we actually tend to use them here, Donegal Weather, Channel Carlow Weather. You know, these are, a lot of them are amateur meteorologists, and I mean that in no negative way. And often their analysis is better than that of Metairn, which costs us a fortune. Hi, Greg. I have it from a very good source. The nitrates directive is gone. Watch this space. Well, I heard a government minister say it effectively themselves, or a junior minister. Last night, I witnessed a young boy on a quad bike purposely sliding and skidding on an icy road in Rafoque. I know for sure the boy's only 11 or 12 years of age. He was on the main road in the town parks area leading to Mongari. I was quite shocked at how dangerous this was, not just for him, but for any motorists who were on that road. It was difficult enough to control a vehicle as it was 9 p.m. and the road was slippy. Also, I can't believe the irresponsibility of the parents who felt that this was okay as they were on the footpath egging him on. Confused as to what to do? Should the Gardaí be involved? I don't know. I don't know. Maybe us reading that out, maybe the message will get through. Ringing the guards, bringing that onto people. But then if you didn't and something bad happened, how would you deal with that? We'll throw it out to the family, that 9 till noon show family, and see what they think. Good morning. What can we do with neighbours who leave their dogs outside and they bark all day and most of the night? So selfish, especially in this freezing weather. It's cruel. Why get dogs and dump them outside in the cold and rain and snow and have no perception that you are annoying the peace and quiet of your neighbours? This is out of the countryside, or in the countryside, sorry, where we built in order that we can get peace and quiet. Can we complain? And if so, who can we complain to? Again, I'll throw that out to the listeners. I mean, if there's a genuine animal welfare concern, you certainly could contact the IRSPCA, isn't it? The IRSPCA, they might have an interest in it if you feel the animals are being mistreated. In terms of the noise, I'm not sure it's a criminal matter. It's probably a civil matter. Certainly, maybe ring the Gardaí and get some guidance from them. A caller says, imagine the benefit to Knock Airport of a train service from Letterkenny to Galway via Sligo. It's time our government woke up to a viable business idea. It would be amazing. It really would. Let me see. We were talking yesterday about Elvis. It would have been his 90th birthday. And apparently, a caller says, Elvis's mother died in her 40s from liver disease caused by the Viking gene alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which is very prevalent here in Donegal. Elvis probably had that gene too from his mother. And the texts and comments keep coming in. Shall I do a few requests? I shall. A few requests and announcements, because we love to do them here on this show as well. Will you wish Ozzy Gallagher in Castlefin a very happy birthday from Scepter in County Meath? Thank you. Happy birthday, Ozzy. More than happy to do so. Greg, can you read out that the table quiz in Ungrian on Hotel tonight has been rescheduled for tomorrow night? It starts tomorrow night at 9 p.m. and proceeds go to the Nazareth House Resident Comfort Fund. Greg, can you wish Renee Moore Cashel, Creasler, a very happy 90th birthday today from Sylvia Thomas and family across in Carrigart? Happy birthday, Renee Moore Cashel. I hope you have a fantastic day. Can I play for a request, please, for Jessica Malloy, who's in Glenties and is 10 today. Delighted to have a snow day to celebrate. Love for Mammy, Daddy, Sister Hannah. Jessica, get out, build a snowman, get Mommy to send us in a picture of it. We'd love to see what you're doing with your snow day. Or fluffy socks, blanket and cartoons on the telly. I think that's what I'd be doing. Joseph Ball, Mountaintop, Letterkenny. Happy birthday, Joseph, from all your grandchildren. More coming in for Joseph. Happy birthday from all the crew. Looking forward to seeing you in Harry's tonight. What would be going on in Harry's? It sounds like good fun. Now, a new biography of Dr. Tom McGinley is to be launched on the fourth anniversary of the Fall Hospice founder's death in January. Author of Dr. Tom McGinley, founder of the Fall Hospice, is Dr. Keith Munro. And Dr. Munro joins us on the programme now. A very good morning to you, and thank you so much for your time, Keith.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning.
Dr. Tom McGinley needs no introduction, really, to the people of the Northwest. But still, I'm sure there's plenty in your work that people will learn, even though they may believe that they know Dr. Tom McGinley very well. A remarkable character held in such high esteem. Talk to me about Dr. McGinley, I suppose, and how far back into his life do you go in his biography, presumably to the get-go?
Well, right back to the beginning, I was going round with a student as a GP, and we were just leaving a lady who was dying from cancer. And I said to the student, you know, this city needs a hospice. And I went to speak to Dr. Aileby Byrne at that time, who was a consultant geriatrician in Altnagelvin. And I said, Aileby, is there something we should do about this? And he said, smiling, you'd better hurry up, because Dr. McGinley started running and started raising money. So I went immediately to see Tom, who I'd known as a GP, but not intimately. I just knew of him. I went over, now this is late 1983, and I said, hello, Tom, I believe you're trying to build a hospice, etc. Can I help? And on that day, he decided to start a steering committee. So we were a steering committee of two, which expanded very rapidly to five or six. And the first decision that we made then was that to launch a 500,000, half a mil fund to build an inpatient unit. And that was launched from the Guildhall in January of 84.
Very ambitious right from the get-go. And I suppose you happened to meet and know Dr. McGinley because he was a medical professional. And that happened somewhat by chance. He was born in the Geltuck village of Derrybeg and studied...
Can I interrupt
please
you
Please do.
He was actually born in the Bronx in New York.
Oh, I beg your pardon. He was raised in Derrybeg, wasn't he?
Yes. December the 26th, 1934, he was born. But they came home because of the Depression, and he was raised, as you say, in Derrybeg.
And what was his life in Derrybeg like? What was his interests? What was his education?
Well, he described his life there as almost idyllic because, okay, it was a Gaeltacht village. They spoke Irish as their first language. But he described the rich tapestry of ever-changing images that he had for the rest of his life. And he said there was always the regularity of the tides coming in, going out, dictating the daily routine. So he describes his young days as carefree, golden days, when we wanted little and yet we had everything. And that summarized him in that way. But he then won a scholarship to St. Eunan's, where you are, Letterkenny. And from there, he actually won a scholarship to University of Galway. And in those days, Greg, you didn't go and say, I have a scholarship to do medicine, scholarship to do engineering. You just were given a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
So this was one of the turning points in his life. He went and he didn't know as he walked through the gates what he was going to study.
Wow.
I think in the back of his mind was he had passions for two things, dancing and Gaelic football. And I think he wanted to enjoy those during his university life. So he went to the registrar and he said, what's the longest course you've got in the university? And the registrar said, medicine. And Tom says, okay, that'll do.
I'm sure he was able to pursue his hobbies as well as his studies because he qualified then and yes. Went on to work as a houseman at Alton na Gelvin Hospital in Derry, this during the early 1960s. Was that straight from college or did he work in Donegal for a time at all in the intervening time?
Yeah, because when he qualified, he did some, he was in Port Iuncula Hospital for a year or two. But he would do some sort of outlying calls, etc., back to Derrybeg and generally the Gweedore area. And they were certainly very happy with him and very proud that one of their own had become, I don't know what it is in Irish, but, a great doctor. And yet he had a yearning to get back after his time in the West, as it were, to within range of, Alton na Gelvin and his home. So he actually grabbed this job that was up for advertising in the early 60s, and he became a houseman in Alton na Gelvin. And it was then he was able to join Dr. Fallon, and Dr. Vincent Kavanagh on the Strand Road in practice. They were looking for a new partner because the senior partner had died. And here comes the very next point that put him in a certain direction. He was treating a young man at home, Michael Donaghy, in 1965, and he was dying of cancer. He was 18, 19 years old, studying for university. And he Tom couldn't handle it. They hadn't been taught how to treat terminally ill people. There were in those days, and I remember that myself, that we were warned not to use too much morphine, keep it to the end, etc. And quite frankly, Greg, hundreds, maybe thousands of people at that time over a period of years died in agony, either in hospital or at home. So he was determined, he was realized that he couldn't treat him properly, and he was determined to never let that happen again to anyone.
And from there, the dream began to form, didn't it, that the area needed a hospice. And that was the seed that, that led to that conversation that you yourself, Doctor, had with Dr. McGinley. He'd already... your interest in the establishment of a hospice, and he'd already been thinking about this for quite some time. So it was a perfect marriage at the right time.
Yes, after the Michael Donaghy incident in 65, he determined that he would study anaesthetics.
Wow.
He was already doing some sessions at Alton McElvin, but he wanted to come from a position of understanding and knowledge so that he could speak to other GPs, nurses, etc. So he decided that he would study for, and eventually he acquired the FFARCS, which is the Fellow of the Faculty of the Royal College of Surgeons. Now, what happened, though, suddenly, out of the blue, a year later in 1966, he became seriously ill. And he was taken to the Royal Victoria Hospital at the time. And his wife then, Deirdre, had to travel up and down to see him. And eventually, they said he had sarcoidosis. And even today, there isn't a cure for it, but it does go away. And exercise, actually, is one of those things that helps. He thought he had cancer at the time, and he was very angry with God. There were a lot of conversations going on. He wouldn't see his children growing up and so on. So he determined, and he was discharged. And then he went to Andy McClay. You probably have never heard of Andy. He's gone now. But he had a gym in Derry on Lawrence Hill. And he went there, and Andy took him over and helped him back to full strength over a number of years, I may say. And he then took up squash, jogging, and his first marathon actually was in 1982. And all the time he had studied for his degree, which he got. And so he was then determined that we would have some new form of palliative care, and he would introduce this. Although we had launched for $500,000 for the inpatient unit, there was another step had to be taken, and that was to create a palliative care service at home. So that was done first.
And Doctor, were the models there for this elsewhere, or was there a uniqueness to the model that, that you guys worked on and established?
Short answer is I'm not actually sure. There have been one or two hospices for a long, long time. I think there's one in Dublin, and I think probably in England. But in fact, it was only in the late 60s that palliative care in England was being developed. And what Tom did quite early on was to introduce the syringe driver. Tom didn't invent it. It had already been invented, but he brought it. And, of course, that revolutionized Briefly, it's a syringe which injects a small amount of a morphine substance under the skin, and it has a little motor. The syringe is charged up for 24 hours, and it administers something every 7 or 8 minutes under the skin, so that the patient has complete pain-free situation where they can actually be walking around in the hospice. All right, they might have to pull a little stand with them or something.
But
like
they're
that.
Not crippled by pain, and they can enjoy remaining life they may have. So if the timelines are correct here, correct me if I'm wrong, Doctor, the steering committee was established in 84, and the doors of the hospice opened in 91. That's just 7 years. Are those timelines correct? And if so, what a remarkable achievement with everything that must be achieved to do this in that period of time.
Yes, he was still doing his anaesthetics. He was doing his GP work, and he was working to establish home care. That was the first thing. And in fact, it was in 1985 that we bought 9 Crawford Square in Derry as a centre for the home care, and employed the first 2 palliative care nurses. They'll be coming on the night, by the way, when we launch the celebration and my book at the end of the month. And other people from the early days who are still with us are also coming along. But that was the beginning of palliative care. And then we had to get land. And that's a whole story. There's a chapter in my book. I won't go into the details now. It's a fascinating chapter because there were twists and turns you wouldn't believe. And eventually we got what is probably the best site a hospice in the whole of the United Kingdom. I say probably because I don't know all of them, but we bought the Orange Field, which was about 40 acres owned by the Orange Order for the marching in the late 60s. So eventually he said to me one day, we were standing up there, and he said, I don't know how to go to the Orange Order because I'm a West Donegal Irish speaker and a Catholic. What should I do? Now, he knew that I was a member of the Baha'i faith. And he said, are you a Protestant Baha'i or a Catholic Baha'i? And I laughed and thought for a minute. And I didn't want to give him a lecture on the Baha'i faith. But I said, no, Tom, I'm a Christian Baha'i. So he went as a Christian, not a Catholic or a Protestant.
And this is all in your book, and this is a man of such stature. I almost feel bad in skipping over things, but that's why you've got this book, and people can and have a deep dive into Dr. McGinley. But just as an insight into the man himself, you know, often we have to pass before people recognise our efforts or what have you, but it wasn't necessarily the case for Dr. McGinley. In 2002, he received a papal knighthood from the Pope, Pope John Paul II, also given the Freedom of Derry in 2014. How was he with dealing with sort of recognition and praise? Because some people aren't fantastic, and others, they say, bring it on. How was Dr. McGinley with these types of credits?
Well, I actually quote Deirdre in the book, his wife, and said that he never, ever sought any of these accolades. I have a chapter on accolades. There are a lot more, but you have highlighted 2 of the ones he was most proud of. But he always dedicated any of these, you know, by saying that it's the people of Derry and the surrounds who built this hospital. Mm-hmm. We get some help from government, but we still have to, you know, raise a lot of money.
Yes, of course.
But he always dedicated it either to the people who helped or the people in the hospice and so on. So he never sought these things.
Mm. But it's nice that he received them. He also worked with many people, I believe Dr. McDade, Dr. James McDade amongst them, in offering advice and knowledge in terms of the establishment of the Donegal Hospice, which is I'm sure, and I have no doubt the full hospice, because I do know how the love that people have and the respect for the services they provide. But he was also very influential in guiding and giving advice to, in terms of the establishment of the Donegal Hospice.
Yes, I'm glad you raised Dr. McDay, because I was with him a week or so back, and hopefully he's coming. He's retired now, as you know. But what happened there, you see, right from the get-go, Tom had the idea of spreading that, you know, our hospice was for everybody. So he didn't see a border existing. And it was also to overcome prejudices of Catholic and Protestant. And also prepare people, the main thing, preparing people for, as we call it, passing over the bridge to the next world. But it was open to everybody, even people without a religion, obviously. So what happened there was that Dr. McDade had a young boy, Adrian Mitchell, age six, who was dying and in a lot of pain and hated having injections and so forth. So, in fact, James McDade consulted Tom at the time, who introduced for the first time, I think he was the youngest person to have the use of a syringe driver. And as a result of that, that acted as a catalyst, because young Adrian died peacefully and pain-free at the end. And so they said, and I quote James McDade, you know, in the book saying, that we decided that we needed a hospice for Donegal. Mm-hmm. Now, very quickly, there were others came around. Similar, really, to Foyle Hospice. The steering committee was two on one day, and within weeks, there were other people coming to join. So that as a result of that, Tom was the medical director for the Donegal Hospice in the very early days. But as you know, it's been independent.
Yep.
But they meet and mix and share, you know.
And so just to let the listeners know, there's a chapter on the forming of the Donegal Hospice. And we talked of accolades too. Obviously, we know Dr. McGinley's love of Donegal and West Donegal. And I presume it was particularly a proud moment for him in receiving the Donegal Person of the Year.
Yes. And at that particular time, although he had spoken often about his mother, May, who was a woman of extreme faith, real faith, and also a wise woman, and he often spoke about her, but he didn't say much over the years about his dad. And it was at that presentation that he raised the issue and dedicated that particular accolade to his father.
What a remarkable insight, yeah.
And I use his words in that chapter.
What was it like for you, Keith, writing this book? Obviously, you knew Dr. McGinley for a long time and had to work closely with him and had so many shared experiences and achievements and knockbacks, and I'm sure everything that went along with the campaign that you were involved with each other on, especially given the fact that he's held in such high regard and his legacy is there for all to see. And it's so important that people now in their controlling and running of the likes of the Foyle Hospice, it's his legacy in which they're trying to protect in offering the very best service that can be available. But from your perspective, Dr. Munro, what was it like to work on this book about your friend, but also such an important person that you've of course had to get it right?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I had stepped down as chairman of the trustees in 2014, so I wasn't involved in the running of anything. And then COVID came along some years later. Tom had retired and he had time with his family and so forth. But so I lost contact, except seeing him occasionally. And then I suddenly realized he died in the middle of COVID. The population and all those who knew Tom at that time or heard of him hadn't the opportunity of celebrating his life or come to the funeral. Even the close family, when he was, it was only close family who was allowed at the funeral. So I realized a year ago, when I went out to his grave, I decided to go to his grave one day, and Kieran was with me, his son. And I said, Kieran, I think the time's right that I do a book on your dad, because this generation, if you ask 1,000 people, have you heard of Foyle Hospice? They'll all say, yes, I've heard of it. Have you heard of Dr. McGinley? Yeah, a bit. And very few people know where he came from and how he achieved this goal with the help of thousands of other people.
Yes.
So that was what set me going a year ago. And I worked with Aisling, his daughter, who lives in County Down. We Zoomed a lot, and she helped me with the book. And I sourced a family book, which has not been made public, and my own book on the history, Building Bridges, it was called, which I did about, God, I think it's 20 years ago now. So that is, you know, this book focuses on Tom, obviously, and it brings some enlightenment to his early life, how he got started, what he did.
Yeah, so it's fascinating because we are, you know, we're things happen in life that direct us to where we end up, and things influence us, and it's great to get an insight into. You know, the people might believe they know Tom McGinley, but how did he get to be the Dr. Tom McGinley you know? And that's the insight that you bring. The book, Dr. Tom McGinley, founder of the Foyle Hospice, it's going to be launched on Wednesday, the 29th of January at 7:15 p.m. in St. Columb's Hall, Orchard Street in Derry. Now, there is capacity for 785 people, which will be consumed rather quickly, I'd imagine. It's free to attend, but obviously organisers and Dr. Keith, I'm sure, wants to know the numbers. So you are, and we'll link it here, you are asked to book online in advance. Now, the book is £15 per copy, and the proceeds, I'm not sure, is it just on the night, Keith, or throughout the course of its publication, but proceeds on the night at least go to the Foyle Hospice.
The proceeds of the book ultimately, on the night, obviously, but thereafter from bookshops and online, there's actually I'm not running it, but Kieran and I'm trying to remember his name. Mr. Soule, who owns the iPrint company,
yes.
Who's printed the book, it will gradually, you know, after expenses of printing and so on, and we got the hall given free, and, you know, people have been very generous. But money, then everything else will go in the name of Tom to the hospice. Mm-hmm. But the books will be sold in the hospice shops, at the fundraising, up at the hospice, the fundraising department, and so on.
Excellent. And it, the front cover features a lovely picture of Dr. Tom McGinley, actually. I'm sure he'd be very pleased with that. Dr. Keith Munro, thank you so much for all of your time. We will advise people of how to book and what have you. These URLs, addresses are hard to take down over the air, but we'll give it to anyone who's interested. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
And you, Greg, thank you very much indeed for having me on.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you. That is Dr. Keith Munro there, author of Dr. Tom McGinley, founder of the Foyle Hospice. So changes to speed limits on rural and local roads, which were due to come into effect are from the 7th of February. The changes are part of Ireland's government road safety strategy running till 2030, which is the primary aim of reducing the number of deaths and serious injuries on Irish roads by 50% by 2030. The first phase of the action plan for the strategy set out the need for a working group of relevant stakeholders to review speed limits. The group published its review in September 2023. Now, rural local roads are going to see the speed limit reduced from 80 kilometres per hour to 60 kilometres per hour. National secondary roads are going to be reduced from 100 kilometres per hour to 80 kilometres per hour. Roads in built-up areas scheduled to be reduced from 50 kilometres an hour to be to 30 kilometres per hour. Now, there are a default limit set in the primary legislation, but then it's up to the council to make some determination. So, say, for instance, it's likely that the road from Letterkenny to Dunfanaghy will be reduced to 80, I'd imagine, and it's probably likely that the road between Ballybofraister and Orler to Donegal Town will remain at 100, is my take on it. But we'll get Kevin's take on it. He has views on this. Kevin, good morning to you.
Greg?
I'm doing okay. Right. So, what's your view on these reductions? I suppose the first tranche, early February, roads are being reduced by 20 kilometres per hour.
Well, initially when I seen it on my phone while I was scrolling through it over Christmas, I thought, I didn't look at what type of road was being reduced, but and I was a bit irate being a road user all over the county. But when I found out, I was talking to somebody yesterday that would know more about what he says. It's only the local road that's been reduced for now, I think. But what you just read out there is they're bringing down, is it secondary roads?
Yeah.
From 100 down to 80.
Yes, but and I've been trying to track this since the announcement was first made, and it's a little bit more complex than all of a sudden now the only speed limit on the roads that we would primarily use would be 80. That's my understanding. But I think what it means is like the road from, say, the road from Letterkenny to Lifford, right? I think most people believe there's not much that road can tolerate 100 kilometres per hour. Pull that one back to 80. But if you turn left and you head into Derry, obviously that road would be retained at 100.
Yes. Well, the road to Lifford, obviously, there's parts of it. You know, you could do 100, no problem. You know, around the Rafoe, turnoff, St. Johnson turnoff area there. You know, there's good stretches there where you can do 100. What I see from driving around the county is, if the limit is say 80, or brought down to 60, people are driving too slow on good parts of the road, which causes major tailbacks, and then you get somebody doing dangerous manoeuvres, passing out lines of traffic where they, you know, where they shouldn't be.
So Kevin, not putting words in your mouth, until such time, we know there are changes are going to be made and we don't necessarily know the ins and outs of it, but I think what you're saying is, you know, it's a blunt instrument and they have to make sure that they don't reduce the speed limit on certain roads that actually adds to danger.
That's right, yeah. That's what I'm getting at, you know. Local roads where I live, you know, there's roads which are 80 now are going to be reduced to 60. And there is parts of the road where you can do 80, which is the old 50 miles per hour, quite safely when the occasion occurs. But when these new laws come in, if they're policed properly, like, people are going to be, you know, fined and get points and what have you to try and save lives on roads which, to my knowledge, haven't had a lot of fatal accidents on them, you know, back roads. People have to use their cop on, you know. Policing, I think, is a bigger problem than, you know, than the speed limits.
I think what happens
that we have
is,
in a minute.
Yeah, I think what happens in terms of new laws and regulations and people think about enforcement, I think there's an awful lot of people, maybe, you know, 60, 65% of people change their behaviour simply because the sign says so. And then what happens is, and I think we saw this with the new quads regulations, Kevin, you just come in and do a blitz, right? So you do one person in one particular area and then the word spreads out, there's a level of enforcement and that catches another 20% of people. And then there's 20% of people perhaps or more or less that just will never adhere to rules and regulations anyway. And I think that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to change driver behaviour for the majority, even though some people will just completely disregard it.
Well, I'm totally, like, obviously I'm not against anything that's going to save lives on the roads, you know, but sometimes it can cause more bother than, you know, than it solves, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I get you. Whenever we change anything, we have to make sure we're doing it right, that it's not a knee-jerk reaction, that rather than spending money on more Gardaí, we're just changing the speed limits because it looks like we're doing something. It has to be the right thing, Kevin, and I agree with you, and we'll have to wait and see. Yeah. Lovely to talk to you, Kevin. Stay safe out and about. Kevin's of the view that we have to be careful that in reducing the speed limits that we don't actually slow traffic up to the point whereby it becomes more dangerous. I wonder, do you agree? 086 60 25,000. We will actually get somebody on from the local authority so that we're speaking in a position of complete knowledge. We will get someone on from the local authority, if they'll work with us on that, to talk about what roads are likely to be affected and how that will all work, because I think we don't want a vacuum of believing that every single road will be reduced by a certain amount and so what. So that's our job here, to get the proper information out to you. So as soon as we can, we'll bring on someone from the local authority and get that all cleared up for you, so you know exactly what the story is.